Now, our next speaker would probably like to maybe counter some of the points that Scott has put forward in his presentation. So I'd like to introduce to you John McInerney. So Professor John McInerney is the Managing Director of Risk Frontiers, a Sydney-based R&D company specialising in natural hazard risk analytics. John has over 100 peer-reviewed publications on various aspects of weather risk, boundary layer physics, and natural catastrophe risks. Please welcome John.
Thank you, Simone, and everyone else. I didn't realise until Scott started speaking that I was expected to be completely outrageous because it was expected to be extravagantly anti-pull. So I'll do my best to live up to that. If you want the hashtag, the conclusion of my talk is that I don't really think poor land use planning is a problem for insurers to solve. And I'll go through some of the reasons for that. Most of the talk stems from a work that Risk Frontiers and Raid Mousselin and George Walker at Aon Benfield did over about 4 years. So it's sort of an empirical study, if you like, looking at pools both here, well, not here, but in the US predominantly, New Zealand, and also Europe. So I'm not going to go through the paper in detail because I've been told that that leads to a very boring talk. I've been told that by some of you, and I'll try to do a bit better today. But the we also looked at as a sort of a counterfactual, the Netherlands, where they've got an obvious problem with flooding, and the government deals with it. So for each of the pools, we posed three questions. So how did the pools price risk? How were the deficits funded? And did the pools encourage disaster risk reduction? And because of the interest in land use planning, and we see a lot of evidence on this when we go out in the field after natural disasters, we concluded with some examples of Australian poor land use planning and the insurance, the capacity of the insurance industry to sort of resolve this. So if those who want to read the full story, here's the paper and I'll make it available to the Institute of Actuaries if they're interested. So let's think a little bit about pools generally. They generally have begun with a market failure. So there's been a big event loss. The insurers either threaten or actually withdraw from the market. Example is the Californian Earthquake Authority. It's actually a privately run pool rather than a government one, but it makes the point. So it grew out of the Northridge earthquake. Insurers were faced with $15 billion worth of claims and had received about $3.4 billion in premiums over the last 25 years. Most of them, in my view, embody an inherent contradiction. So they seek explicitly to provide low-cost insurance, so affordable insurance, to people in high-risk areas. And while that works pretty well in the electorate, as one congressman was quoted as saying, nobody ever got unelected by promising cheap insurance. But it doesn't make sense financially, at least to me. It's often difficult to know how well these things really work until they're really tested, and you know, Christchurch exposed EQC, all its performance issues. I'm not really criticising it, but you know, this was a huge event, and I think arguably EQC ended up doing a lot of things that it hadn't anticipated doing And also in the UK, they for a long time, since the 60s, they had a what was a, called a gentleman's agreement. It was a cosy arrangement between insurers and government in respect of providing flood insurance. And that worked really well until it started raining. So the other thing is the details really matter, and I'll make that point again, and the mission matters as well. I mean, again, who would have expected EQC to be spending a lot of time project managing repairs on homes? So I'll just pick out a few of the pulls. Ray's going to talk in more detail about the National Flood Insurance Program. So this is a national program, one of the few that's not state-based in the US. It's administered by the Federal Emergency Management Association. It covers storm surge as well as flood, so although it sounds like NFID, it's not. It's nearly $25 billion in the Federal Reserve, and on Scott's recommendation, I think it's doing a brilliant job of running a deficit. It's and if we, you know, there's absolutely no way that this money is ever going to be paid back unless we go have 10 years or a bit longer maybe even with no claims at all. In a recent Department of Homeland Security discussion document made the point, makes it very clear that they want to reduce the burden of flood payments on taxpayers. And in one of their key things is asking insurers to come up with innovative solutions. So they really want this to be not a government problem. Just one of the sort of silliness that goes on. Rob talked about the demands are just never stopping. NFIP has a severe repetitive loss program where it's trying to reduce the number of buildings that are repeatedly flooded. And it's probably, the statistics are probably different now after Sandy, but before then about 1% of their properties were responsible for 25 to 30% of their claims. And if you go through the first examples that were given by the Washington Post, you can see examples of a house in Baton Rouge valued at $55,000 or $56,000, and it's been flooded 14 times since the people have been living there. And nearly $500,000 in claims. And these would be non-normalised costs, so the situation's actually a lot worse than that. But this speaks to the affordability problem. What does the owner of that home do? I mean, the average cost of a home in America is about $200,000. In Baton Rouge, it might be a bit less. But even if the government brought that house out for its market value, they're not going to be able to go and live somewhere else. So now they stay there and have the interesting situation which they get their furniture changed once a year. So another one is citizens in Florida, and I really wanted to talk about this. I'm not going to go into detail, but just to say how these things are funded. So they're funded by premiums, obviously, but assessments, which are really levies on participating insurance companies, and borrowings. And it says in their documentation explicitly, the same phraseology, want to provide affordable cover for catastrophic windstorm events in high-risk areas along the Florida coastline. So the shortfalls, the deficits, which are inevitable the way these things are structured, you have policyholder surcharges, there's levies put, higher levies put on the insurance companies, and also bonding, so raising debt. So all of this has to be paid for, and it's correct that the government would have a lower cost of capital than a private company, but it's not free. And the other thing that's interesting about the Florida situation is that insurance companies who are participating have to also take part in the Florida Hurricane Catastrophe Fund, and this provides low-cost reinsurance. So the idea is that, well, the consequence of that is that the risk is even more concentrated in the state rather than diversified around the international reinsurance market. EQC, is a bit different. So it's automatic first loss cover, and it's anybody who has fire insurance pays this automatically. The premiums have gone up twice in the last, since the 2011 earthquakes, but it's now set at 20 cents per $100 of insured value, and it's capped. And that doesn't matter whether you're in Northland, which has almost zero earthquake risk, or in Wellington, it's the same everywhere. And it's currently under review, but I think the Treasury is quite keen on keeping this sort of flat, non-risk rated premiums, and the reason for that they give is affordability. The UK, this is a pretty new scheme, Flood Re, and we haven't really seen it in action yet, but it's after a long negotiations with the government, it's the private sector who's picked up on this. So it's a not-for-profit fund, it's managed by the insurers, covers 2% of the worst risks, and the premiums are capped and subsidised by a levy on all other properties. So that's not a large amount, it's about £10 or something is my recollection. It's only designed for a short length of time, well, a finite length of time, 25 years. So I think that's sort of unlikely. Once these things start, they're hard to get rid of and hard to correct their faults. It won't cover properties built after January 1, 2009, and I take that to mean that new properties are going to be have to be built off the floodplain or built, if they are on the floodplain, in ways that are resilient to flooding. And something that's wasn't defined when we were looking at this was that the government will take the tail end risk, but it's not clear whether that's a 1 in 200 year event on a given catchment or whether it's a national loss. And of course the Netherlands, they 55% of their land is prone to flooding of one sort or another, and the government says that's too big a role for the insurance for the private sector and has taken on engineering solutions to that. So this followed a huge storm surge that overtopped and destroyed levees in 1953. 1850 odd people were killed, 100,000 people were evacuated. And it set off these things that was only finished in 1997. So what happens if there is a big flood, again at the moment in the absence of private insurance or much of it, it's going to come back to a government decision with the amount of money that they have available at the time. So the details matter. Term that comes up often when you're looking at these pools is the term actuarial sound, which I now understand to mean that 7 out of 10 actuaries think what you've done is pretty cute. If we look at the National Flood Insurance Program, 3 of those dissenting actuaries worked for the Government Accounting Office and decided that it was actuarially unsound by design, and we'll talk a bit about that later. Now, of course, what I didn't realise at the moment, because we're Australia, we have been moving towards risk-based pricing for a long time, is that a pool can be actuarially sound, of course, from a solvency perspective. It can deal with all its statutory obligations, but it may not employ risk-reflective premiums, and that's sort of the case, I suppose, in the Spanish consortio, where they have pots of money, and but they don't distinguish risk at a local level. Everyone pays the same. But if you go down this track, that what it explicitly means, and I think Scott talked about this with his haystack example, it means that low-risk householders are subsidising those more at risk. And if you take the example in Florida, it's argued that about nearly 80% of low-risk property owners are subsidising those fat cats who can afford beachside properties along the coast. NFID, so actuarially unsound, but in their terms it means that premiums aim to cover the average sort of historical loss experience. So you take the last 20 years of losses, you leave out Katrina because that's obviously statistically anomalous and would never happen again, and then you average all of those and you make that your premium. Well, the problem is with these things, particularly when you're dealing with one hazard, is that the distribution of losses is going to follow a heavy tail distribution. So there's more probability in the tail than is the case for, say, your normal Gaussian statistics. So big stuff happens more often than you'd like. And so if you run it at this sort of low-level average, of course you're going to run a deficit. In the case of Citizens and something in Texas, the Texas Windstorm Insurance Association, they're sort of on a glide path to trying to sort of asymptotically get to actuarially sound premiums. They're also trying to shed lots of properties, because being the cheapest in the market meant that they were sort of competing against other insurance companies. But what they mean by one, in the case of Citizens, they have actuarially sound means that they can deal with a 1 in 100 year event, where in Texas it means they have to, they look at their modelled losses over time and they have to try and match that. And of course the problem with these sort of things is that they ignore the clustering of events that can happen at times in seasons or in between seasons. And at a board meeting of the TWIA, the chief actuary was asked whether they could deal with a 1 in 100 year event in two seasons, and his answer was probably not, but it was very unlikely. We've actually seen things like that happen quite often. When we're dealing with deficits, NFIP, technically insolvent, Citizens, at least at the time we were writing, had been through the longest hurricane drought on record, and they were feeling fairly buoyant to the point that they were wanting to lower prices in some places. EQC wiped out, or the Christchurch earthquakes wiped out their $6 billion in reserves and one or two events, and they could fall back onto the government guarantee. And then the Californian Earthquake Authority has no government guarantee, and the deficits would be funded by surcharges on premiums and prorated payout claim settlements. And you can see why this system is so popular, because your house is damaged in an earthquake and then you receive a bill from the CEA to say that we have to fund the payouts, and then they say you're only going to get 20% of what you thought you were insured for, because the extent of the damage is so great. And that's sort of partly reflected in the fact that only 12% of people who are at risk to earthquakes in California have taken this up. And when it comes to encouraging risk reduction, most of them don't have a very good record. NFIP does put pressure on community to try and limit development beyond the 1 in 100 year flood height. People question how well that's effective that's been, and of course, but a lot of flooding in recent years has happened in areas where there's no map, so people don't have any idea what the flood risk is. I think the Texas system is probably the most successful in this regard. It offers premium discounts for compliant housing design, and people expect to have, when they buy a property, to have a certificate from the Texas Department of Insurance. And EQC does a lot of really good R&D, supports a whole lot of R&D in turn that monitor earthquakes and also have been instrumental in sort of helping new building codes to come into effect. But because their premiums are not risk reflective, there's absolutely no incentive for no financial incentive for a homeowner to go and retrofit their house. Rob carried the, I think, dealt with this pretty well. We are in a different position, particularly when you look at the US, I think, where they would like to be in the sense of having this risk-reflective premiums. Most of the European things tend to be more socialist in design. It's probably too early to say how effective this is being in changing people's behaviour, but when you think about it, who else but insurers have an explicit incentive to understand and price risk, and who else but insurers can reward a homeowner for reducing risk? Pools could do that, but most of the ones we looked at didn't. So coming back to, I guess this is my key point, and again it echoes what Rob said. Insurance is a business, it seems to me, that transfers risks to people who can have a greater diversification capacity, and I probably learnt that phrase from RAID. It confers financial resilience on the insured, but it doesn't do anything to mitigate the hazard. It doesn't stop the event from happening. It just helps the recovery or the financial recovery. And it's impossible, talk for ages about this, but it's impossible to ignore the role that poor land use planning has played in this country in contributing to the increasing cost of natural disasters. And local councils who benefit from these decisions remain largely unaccountable. I've been given the fingers, so let me finish quickly. So what has made the difference? Well, if we look at Christchurch, the de-risking of the redevelopment, it's a large measure coming back to government. Now, insurers and EQC would have been involved in these discussions, but in the end we had redlining of liquefaction-prone areas and buyback of land. We've had upgrading of building codes where they're almost to the level of what they have in Christchurch in terms of the peak ground acceleration that buildings need to be built to. The Netherlands, okay, it's a government responsibility. Roma and Emerald was an example of Suncor's sort of market power at the time, and Rob's talked about that. And then I think the other thing is ICA deserves a lot of credit and funding. NFID, now I have to say that I'm a beneficiary of that through Risk Frontiers' involvement, but of course I think the industry as a whole and the nation really is benefiting from that. So I'll finish there and just leave you with some questions to think about. Cheers.